welcome to Sleep Podcast with me, Mitchell Willis, and him, Michael Holt.
Good afternoon.
How are you?
Very well, thank you. Yeah, it's a lovely Tuesday afternoon in Leeds, and I'm excited to talk about the football that happened this weekend. What about you? Did you have a nice one? Did you have a good weekend?
I did. I had a boozy one.
Did you?
Yeah, never mind dry January. I went to a beer festival.
You went to wet January.
Very, very wet. Not damp. Soaking.
Good. And have you recovered from said beer festival?
I think I'm hangover free so far.
Magic.
In January 2019. How was your weekend?
Very low key, thank you. Yeah, I watched the football on Saturday at 3 o'clock and may well have convinced a family member to put £10 on Southampton losing at half time, which went really well.
More on that later.
Exactly. But no, other than that, very, very little. And the good thing was there was a lot of football to get our teeth into and a lot, therefore, to discuss.
There was indeed. And we've got to go to Sunday, and I might have pretended I had a hangover so I could just sit and watch football all day.
Ah, I see. Okay.
But I didn't. I felt fresh. And I felt fresh watching Tottenham, Manchester United. It was Manchester United who won this one. And I really enjoyed it. I think it was a very intriguing game. And although just 1-0, could have easily been 3-3.
It could, yeah. And I text you. I think there's about 35 minutes gone in this one. And I said, this is rubbish. This
worst
is
game
really,
you've ever seen,
yeah, I said, this is terrible. And then it kind of sprang to life, didn't it?
Yeah.
I think tactically, Manchester United got it spot on in the first half. It looked like the warm weather training that they'd been doing over in Dubai had paid off. And the players just looked fitter than Tottenham's players at that stage. And they were pressing high. They were creating mistakes from a Tottenham side that you're not necessarily used to seeing from them. And then it all kind of switched around a little bit in the second half, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. I think, you know, we have to look at that first half performance because, as you say, tactically, they did get it right. And It was relatively simple as well. I think that's the frustrating thing from Tottenham's perspective. You know, they invited the fullbacks on, and in doing so, they created a lot of space through the channels, and they looked to get the ball into the channels as quick as possible, use the pace of Rashford and Martial. And, you know, it paid dividends, and we have to look at the goal in particular as well. The ball from Pogba was perfect, and the finish as well was as good as it gets. You know, you don't get a lot of the goal in front of you when you're Rashford in that position, but he finds basically the only place that he could have got it. I think if you look at Lloris in the build-up to the goal as well, he's almost looking to play as a bit of a sweeper because I think he and the team have acknowledged that there's a little bit of room there, and I think you can see him kind of scrambling across his goal and potentially slightly out of position, but I don't think you could criticise him too much.
Yeah, I was going to say there was a moment on Sky Sports when they were sharing the game and he kind of looks back to get his bearings and his position right in terms of the goal and he's shitting himself. He just looks he looks like he knows what's going to happen, and I think you're right. I think Marcus Rashford deserves a huge amount of credit because he put it in the one place that he could, and Lloris obviously got a hand to it as well, so it shows what a powerful shot it was across the keeper from that range, which it's a difficult skill, and I'm not convinced it's something that Rashford's always had in his game. I think he has developed as a striker and has become a better finisher in recent years. You maybe would have looked, I don't know, 18 months ago and he could have snatched at that opportunity and maybe hit it at the wrong time, but I think he knew that they weren't going to get a plethora of opportunities at Wembley on Sunday, and that's why he really took his time and made sure that he put it in the place that he needed to.
And do we think that he's the number one striker there now? I mean, you only have to look at the work they've done in recent weeks to see that, you know, they've acknowledged that for them they've got a very strong attack, probably still not the best in the league, but I think you'd say that's probably the stronger area of their team when you look at the defence, and I think from that perspective, Rashford seems to fit into the system they're looking to play.
Yeah, we mentioned it last week. They are very top-heavy in terms of the quality that runs through that side, and the one thing that they struggled with was clean sheets, and obviously we'll come to that in a second, but as far as Rashford goes, I think that he deserves to start through the middle. He's much more potent than...
It suits him, doesn't it?
Yeah, of course it does. And the issue that you've got is Solskjaer wants to play with pace, and Lukaku, unfortunately, just doesn't give you that. He's very good front on. When you look at how powerful he is in his game, he's great, but he just doesn't have the same pace. And if Pogba had played that ball through to him on Sunday, the likelihood is that the defender would have got back and probably actually got to the ball before him. And that's the difference in terms of having both Martial and Rashford up there. You know that you can hit a ball over the top. You can play against teams who do play with a high line.
Yeah, and you know, we said before that the game did very much change from the second half, and on a different day, Spurs taken one of their 100 chances. You know, they could have gone on to win the game ultimately. But what I just want to get your thoughts on the commentators and subsequently the media purring over David De Gea's performance. Now, before we go any further, we have to say that he did make a number of saves, and there were some good saves in there. But for Gary Neville to say that he should frame his boots, are we saying that he won the game for them, or are we saying actually, if you look at it, there's a lot straight at him?
I've thought about this quite a bit since the game, because at the time I was in that boat. I kind of thought, do you know what, he's had a good day. We've all seen goalkeepers who've had days like that, but actually it's probably more down to the lack of quality in the finishing from the Tottenham players. And that was my opinion for a day or so, and then I watched the game back again, and actually you look at his positional sense, and I think I thought of a real life example in terms of when I used to play football, when we used to play five-a-side, how frustrating it would be when you knew that you were playing against a goalkeeper who was just making save after save, and you start to doubt yourself. You start to think of actually putting the ball in an unnatural position, or trying to put it into the near corner rather than going across the keeper. Yep. And it plants that seed of doubt in the opposition's mind, and I think that's possibly what De Gea deserves so much credit for on Sunday, because the saves, when you look at them, were pretty routine. But actually, to make that many one after another, he does deserve a huge amount of credit for. I'm not convinced he's the best goalkeeper in the world. I think it's a debate that will rumble on, because it is subjective. There's absolutely no way of knowing who the best goalkeeper in the world is. And the fact that people haven't been able to split the likes of Edison and Alisson this year, and De Gea has not really been part of that conversation, shows the quality that we've got in the Premier League. But I think you have to just put it down as a Tottenham player to one of those days. Pochettino came out after the game. He said that he was incredibly happy with how his players performed, that it was one of the best performances in all of his time there. Now, I wouldn't necessarily agree with that, but I think for the amount of clear-cut chances that they created on another day, they probably would have won that game 3-1.
Yeah, I'd say it was an off day, and I think for them, they've obviously got Son going over off to the Asian Games now, and that's going to be a huge loss for them. I thought he was quite a bit pedestrian at the weekend, to be honest. I was kind of looking for him as a... I had my fantasy football hat on, thinking, right, it's his last game, he's going to do something. And I think the loss of Sissoko was massive for Spurs, because that changed the formation. I think Son had to go wider, and, you know, Sissoko, before he went off, I was actually really impressed with him. He was driving through the Manchester United midfield, he was breaking things down, and I think you only have to look at where the goal came from as well to suggest that potentially, you know, he has an impact in stopping that too. And I think, you know, going forward for Spurs now, yes, they look at it as an off day, but Kane possibly struggling for fitness. They have got favourable fixtures, though, so potentially they have two or three, four easy games or easy-ish games, and they can coast through those. But, you know, they're ultimately against a rival, and they've lost at home, and that's the big takeaway from this.
And also, I think you look at it from a Manchester United point of view, the gap between them and Arsenal now is nothing, and I think they're only a few points behind Chelsea, whereas when Solskjaer took over, it was, I think, 8-9 points, something like that, and I don't think anyone necessarily expected them to overhaul those teams, let alone catch them. So you can look at it two ways, really. You can look at it as an off day for Tottenham, or you can look at it, actually, it's two home defeats on the bounce. They've lost to Wolves, they've lost to Manchester United, and is it a little bit of a struggle for them to actually go again in the Premier League? We don't know what the extent of Harry Kane's injury is. Actually, it could have just been a knock. He might run it off. And with the fixtures they've got coming up, you wouldn't be surprised to see them get back on the horse. But it's intriguing. It's always nice when you actually have talking points after a fixture like this, because there's been a few so far this season that have flattered to deceive a little bit. And when you talk about two of the big six going head-to-head, this is the sort of game that you want to talk about.
Absolutely. Well, on that note, let's move to the bottom of the league. Burnley 2, Fulham 1, and I think we've got to get it out there first. Burnley won a game, scoring two goals without having a shot on target.
It's magical. The Premier League delivers again, and Claudio Ranieri would have probably had, I don't know, one of the last things that he said to his side before they went out. Lads, just keep it tight. Make sure that there's nothing stupid for the first half an hour. Let's keep a clean sheet. And by any means, don't do the worst thing possible and score two own goals. I think Jeff Hendrick has been a little bit harshly dealt with, because his shot was pretty much going in. I think we'll talk about Shane Long a little bit later on, but a lot of that ball looked like it was flying straight past the keeper. And I, on another day, was it Joe Bryan who deflected it in for the first one? If he wasn't there, I think that probably would have gone top corner. But Burnley will take it, absolutely. And at what point does a shot on target not become a shot on target? I mean, that ball was going in, and it's been deflected in. So
the stats don't lie.
Yeah, supposedly it's just a really weird game, and a game that Ranieri would have targeted to get points from as well. And that's probably the most disappointing thing as a Fulham fan, is they've been the undoing of the whole result themselves. They could have avoided that, and it started so well as well.
Well, that's it. Just, you know, the most frustrating thing is that to go a goal ahead in just 2 minutes, and what a goal it was as well. You know, we talk about Andros Townsend's goal being goal of the season. For me, that was as good. It was, you know,
really?
Yeah, it was technically as good. You know, it's a completely different goal, but and you know, you talked about it being a moment within a game as well, and unfortunately this was far from being a moment in the game given what happened. But
you just love it when they're going off the bar, don't you?
Yeah. And it does look so much better as well. But, you know, ultimately we know from Fulham that they're always likely to concede, and I just think the frustrating thing for them is to get that one goal cushion straight away as well. They should be going to build on that, and obviously they've had a lot of undoing, and they're very, very unlucky in doing so as well. You know, poor Dennis Adoy and Joe Bryan, as you said. You suspect that Burnley would no doubt have bombarded them at some point, but, you know, realistically, you would like to think Fulham would sit back a bit and use the players that have got going forward that you probably can rely on a little bit more.
Serve Dennis Adoy right. He shouldn't have done a somersault when he scored against Oldham in the FA Cup last week. I think that's just karma coming back to get him. But you're right. You should be able to build on that, and especially with a defensively minded coach like Ranieri, that would be the ideal situation, really. Go ahead early and then just kind of sit back, soak up the pressure. We know what Burnley are like as well. They're not a side who will just continue to bombard you with attacks. They like other teams to have the ball. They like to play on the break, and it's just another opportunity that's passed Fulham by. And Ranieri's got a decent amount of points so far from his from the games that he's been in charge for, but you look at it and I think his record's around a point a game. Now that's not going to be enough to keep them up unless teams above them start to seriously falter, and that's the predicament as a Fulham fan. Do you stick or twist? Do you go with this defensive minded football and try and keep the other team down to not scoring many goals and try and either nick one or just grind out draws, or do you go for it a little bit more and kind of put your foot on the accelerator and really allow your players to go out there and perform? And it's so hard when you're towards the bottom of the league, especially when you have luck like they did in this game.
Well, that's it. You know, you talk about bad luck, but doesn't get much worse for Fulham when you look at they've had over 70% possession. However, the back five conceded possession nearly 100 times in this game, which I would say against almost anyone else in the league would have resulted in an absolute hammering. So I think they probably need to invest in the window just to do something different. I mean, you've got the vice chairman, Tony Khan, has vowed the club will spend money again despite criticism from the fans. He was told to get out of the club by one fan on Twitter. His response?
Yeah, before you say his response, he was actually... The gentleman was very polite. He said, "Will you get out of my club, please?" And I don't think that you can underestimate somebody being polite in this sort of situation. It's a very Fulham thing to do, isn't it?
It is. So you're saying the response, "Never, I will die at this club, go to hell," was unwarranted?
No, I think the go to hell part particularly was one of the worst things I've ever heard a member of a board direct at a fan, really. It's just crazy, and unfortunately in the world of social media these sort of things do crop up from time to time, but it's a particularly bad one for somebody you should probably know better.
Are they right to be criticised though, the board? You know, they've backed the club, they've got them in the Premier League, they've backed the club. You could question whether sacking Jokanović was the right thing to do, bringing Ranieri was the right thing to do, but ultimately in terms of spending money at the start of the season, on paper we had Fulham down to do a lot better based on the signings that they've made, and the only criticism we probably had was they maybe made too many at one time. Now that may well happen again in January. You know, they may add another four players, and they've got over 11 new players since this time last season, but the board have backed the team.
Yeah, I don't think it's fair, really. I mean I understand that Fulham fans have probably got a little bit ahead of themselves thinking that the amount of money that they spent in the summer they would be doing a lot better, but ultimately, like you say, if it wasn't for the current board, then they wouldn't have spent that money. They wouldn't be in the position that they're in. And you look at the transfer window so far, there's not been many moves. There haven't been any real big money signings yet in the Premier League. And I think that teams will wait towards the end of the window. It tends to be that one move sparks three or four. Yep. And Fulham are probably just playing that waiting game, especially the fact that they're also looking for loan players as well, given the outlay in the summer. The loan market does tend to sort of spring up in the last few days. And they'll be looking to bring players in, of course they will. But at the moment, Ranieri's only got the squad that he's got, and that's all that he can work with until new faces come through the door. So if I was a Fulham fan, I'd probably be quite confident in the team doing something in the transfer window. I suppose it just depends whether those players are going to fit Ranieri's philosophy or whether they'll be players that the board believe will make a difference going forward.
And last word on Burnley, 3 wins on the bounce for them, sees them in 15th, a couple of points off the relegation zone, and after a penalty in the FA Cup, these own goals, you know, their long-awaited look run out, or is it a springboard to get them back up the league?
Well, you'd imagine by looking at it that they will see these 3 wins on the bounce as probably the best football that they've played in 6-9 months.
Yep.
And it will prove Sean Dyche as the right man for the job, if you like. The fans have never wanted him out of the club, and they've always stuck by him, and you can see why. He's beginning to get results. They're beginning to go back to basics and trying to play football a little bit more like they were towards the start of last season, and it's paying dividends, and I'm looking forward to going there in a few weeks to see what they've got to offer.
Indeed, and speaking of Southampton, they beat Leicester City 2-1, and they'll be buoyed by their win this weekend, I would say.
Yeah, like I said at the start of the show, I watched the game, and the minute that we went down to 10 men, I kind of knew what was going to happen. Same old Southampton, the amount of times that we squandered a one-goal lead, let alone 2 goals, and it's just, it begins to grate on you as a fan, and you begin to just think the same old thing's going to happen. It's very much Groundhog Day when it happens, and it seems like since the Hutch has come in, he's been more resolute, he's got a little bit more steel about the players, and as much as Leicester had a huge amount of possession and scored a very scrappy goal, they didn't really create that many clear-cut chances in the second half, and that was down to the work of the players that were on the pitch. Leicester moved the ball around very quickly as well, so you can't really underestimate how difficult it was for those 10 men, and I think that the players in this one probably deserve more credit than the manager. It's clear that the manager's managed to instill what he wants them to do, and they've taken a lot from that. There was a couple of interviews after the game where the players said that if it wasn't for what he'd done on the training ground, they wouldn't have been able to go out there and apply those tactics. But naturally, you don't train all week 10 versus 11. You train 11 versus 11. And to be put in that situation for such a long amount of time, I think they deserve massive credit to go out there and get the win. And I'm not just saying that as a Southampton fan, because you know how pessimistic, yep, I am generally about the team, but it's nice to see a bit of confidence, and it's nice to see a little bit of team spirit, and it's nice to see Shane Long getting a goal as well.
That's what I was going to say. You know, ultimately there's a lot more confidence instilled in the team, and you know, you can see the marked difference between what he's doing and what Mark Hughes was doing, and you know, the personnel hasn't changed. I don't think the tactics have changed massively. It's just a little bit more grit and determination in there as well. And as you say, you know, you've got someone like Shane Long who Hasenhüttl has been very positive about him, and he obviously sees the benefit in what he can do playing in the system that he wants to do. You know, a high press, working the channels, and who knows? You know, maybe he goes on a run and scores 2 in a year.
I'm not convinced that's going to happen. I think Shane Long's probably utilised in that role because he's the only striker that we've got who's actually got out and out pace. I think Danny Ings is okay at that sort of job, but the danger is he could tweak something at any time, whereas Shane Long seems to be able to run and is very rarely injured. So I think he deserves credit, not for the finish, because I'm convinced it was going wide. I think Kasper Schmeichel directed it into goal, but we'll give it to Shane for the time being, unless somebody decides to take it off him. I understand what you're saying about the difference between Hughes and Hasenhüttl, and James Ward-Prowse was interviewed after the game, and he said the difference between the two managers is we know what we're doing off the ball.
Yeah.
Whereas I think under Mark Hughes, he probably had relatively decent tactical nous when it came to what to do when you had it, and to try and get it to the wide players, to try and get it into space, and the football wasn't terrible. It was just the results were really, really poor. I think now when we don't have the ball, you look at who presses when, who stays back. They all have a trigger point, was what Shane Long called it, where the ball comes into their area or their zone, and they know at that point they have to approach the man with the ball. So yep, it's really interesting, and it's nothing new. It's something that Klopp's been the probably number one person to implement it into the English game, really. It's another version of the gegenpress, and it's nice to see your players working so hard, and it's nice to see that they actually deserved the win on Saturday as well. If Leicester had hit the post, the bar, and Alex McCarthy had made loads of saves, then you maybe wouldn't take as much from it as a victory. But actually, I think that we deserved the win, regardless of whether we had 11 or 10 men on the pitch.
And crucially, out of the relegation zone, some good fixtures coming up as well. Everton and Palace at home, and as we said, that big game away at Burnley. And I think looking at Leicester, you know, a defeat for them, a frustrating one after the disappointment of the exit in the FA Cup. And I said when I saw the score on Saturday that I thought, you know, that could be it for Club. Well, really, could be gone by the end of the January transfer window, and it still wouldn't surprise me. And, you know, the fans don't really want him. I'm not really sure the players do either. And I think maybe the biggest question, stumbling block, is who they go for next and what direction they want to go in, because we know where they are. We know they're realistically going to stay there for a relatively long period of time, assuming that nothing major changes at the club. And we know what probably they need to go and do, and that's probably invest a little bit of money, that's go and win one of the cups. And I think at the minute they're in a fairly static position, and potentially what's happened off the pitch may prevent anything major from happening kind of behind the scenes. But there's clearly something somewhere in that club that's not quite right at the moment, and I'd say most fingers point to Puel.
Of course they do. And Leicester fans obviously are fully aware of what he achieved with Southampton. We touched on it last week. And I personally, if I was a Leicester fan, and this is with massive hindsight, I'd probably look to stick with him until the end of the season. I don't think there's any point in getting rid of somebody who's currently got you in eighth position in the Premier League. The football may be turgid, but ultimately, if you finish in the top eight or the top seven, you've got a much better opportunity of attracting players in the summer than if you finish sort of 14th, 15th. And I'm not convinced that a mid-season change is going to make a massive difference to that club at this moment.
Couple of other things just while we wrap up that game. Valerie Wright to be sent off.
Yeah, I think it was just naive. The dive, as some people have called it, for a penalty. I'm not convinced it was a dive. I think that he's probably made the most of the situation. There was contact there, and I think the referee's probably got it right. I don't think that it was a penalty, but equally, I don't think that he had to go down in the manner that he did. Chilwell was trying to get him sent off from the word go, and the manager came out after the game and said actually he was going to substitute him at half time, but unfortunately he didn't quite make it through to that point. Probably could have been sent off for a studs up challenge as well. So you would argue that, yeah, the red card was deserved. He probably just should have got it a little bit earlier on.
Vardy's dive?
Yeah, that was a dive. A definite dive.
Should it be punished afterwards? Because you can't, if it's not given.
Yeah, this is the ridiculous thing. You can't go back, because the whole point is the referee's not been deceived. And Jamie Vardy, much like Harry Kane in the game against Chelsea last week, there was a lot of people talking about after the game, and a lot of people were saying, well, actually, there was a little bit of contact, but there's nowhere near enough contact to go down. And not only that, there was no contact on the area which he reacted to. So you see it again, it is a dive, and that's the difficulty. Why should somebody who is convinced to be deceiving the referee get a ban for it, where he gets away for it, when he gets away with it because the referee's decided not to give the penalty?
Did he save himself by not really appealing for it? I thought that might have been his saving grace, because it looked like he kind of went over almost expecting contact, like we've said before, that it's not necessarily a premeditated dive in the fullest extent, so he's realised and not bothered.
I think that he may well have anticipated contact, but to go down like that, the intent was to win a penalty. It wasn't. He had no intention of trying to get anywhere near the ball, and I think that's the issue here, and that's where they need to remove this grey area from the rules, because it's not fair that next week a player for a different side does it and ends up with a 3-game ban, and his team might win the game 3-0. It just doesn't make any sense the way that the rules are laid out at the moment. But you would imagine that with the introduction of VAR next season, we won't be having as many of these conversations.
Absolutely. And last point, what was the Hutches cap all about? Dreadful bit of merch. It's like something you get outside the ground.
I don't know what it is about these managers who've managed in the Bundesliga. David Wagner wears a cap, Jurgen Klopp wears a cap, and so does Hasenhüttl. I don't know whether they were like things used to get thrown at them when they were managing over there.
I think their idol's just Tony Pulis.
I
think they've just all grown up with Tony Pulis at the helm of Stoke City.
Possibly that could be it, yeah.
Speaking of David Wagner, before we get onto the obvious with him, Cardiff 0, Huddersfield 0. A result that really neither side would have wanted. Not a huge amount to say about the game at all, really. 0-0 at the finest order. Neither side wanted to lose, and it showed. And in terms of the performance, the chances created, I think you'd imagine Cardiff will be disappointed. Equally, Huddersfield couldn't really afford not to win this one. And then as the game is concluding, there's the big decision. The referee gives a penalty. The linesman takes it away. What do you reckon?
I think it was a penalty.
Me too.
I think it was probably a soft penalty, but I think by the laws of the game, he impeded him. He stopped him from getting to the ball, and I don't really understand how the linesman had a better view than the referee. The referee was looking square on at it. The linesman was basically behind the two players, and that's why I was surprised, because normally if the referee gives a penalty, the linesman won't overturn it. It's the other way around. If the referee misses something, then he'll often go to the linesman to give it. But yeah, your opinion the same?
Yeah, I mean, telling for me was the fact that Joe Bennett looked at him, and you know, he knew he was there. If he hadn't looked at him, I'd say it was, you know, it was a bit more accidental, but it's unfortunate for Huddersfield because they could have won that game and things may have panned out differently, because, as we've said, Dave Wagner has left the club by mutual consent, and it's an interesting one. I think it's quite a surprise. Despite the fact that Huddersfield are bottom of the league, they've had a terrible season, it's still quite surprising. And I think we only asked the question last week whether this would happen, and I think ultimately we never ever expected him to get sacked. Which he hasn't, and I think it's been refreshing to see the comments that have come out and the kind of plaudits has been given from within the club. I think we may have a slight difference of opinion on how easy the meeting went, but I think for me, he's realised that he's probably taken them as far as he can do with the resources that he's got. He did a fantastic job last year. It was incredible. And I think to do that 2 years on the bounce, especially with the position they're in at the moment, is almost impossible. And I think for him, he has done the best thing, well, potentially done the best thing for the club in stepping aside as well.
I find it difficult that there's still a bit of uncertainty over what's actually happened here. And my view on it is that, and Dean Hoyle talked about this quite a lot in the statement that he made, that David Wagner probably went in there at the start of January and said, look, these are the tools that I need to get out of it. If you're unwilling to spend X amount of money, then the chance of me keeping the side in the Premier League is very slim. And at that point, a decision was made that in the summer he would go regardless. And then obviously a couple of weeks down the line, they've decided that now's the best time to go. And I would agree with that, really, because I think if you know that a manager's going to leave in the summer, then naturally there will be a dip, whether that be at the moment or whether that be towards the end of the season when their fate's probably been decided. And I think that Dean Hoyle would have done absolutely everything to convince him not to go, whereas I think your opinion is he probably had his severance papers ready. And the reason that I think that is because when Dean Hoyle released this statement, he talked about the fact that they'd been in the highest position in league football for, I think he said, about 50 years. And when you look at that, we talked on the show a couple of weeks ago about the discussions that I've had with Huddersfield supporting friends, and they've said that they've watched the best football team that their club's played in their lifetime. They've been to Wembley, they've won a playoff final. They never believed that they'd be in the Premier League. And I think that David Wagner, in my opinion, would have had a job for life there, regardless of whether they're bottom of the league or not, because ultimately that's where everyone expects them to be. And I think that it's probably a good thing that they've talked about the fact that mentally he's exhausted and he's struggling to really go through the motions of everyday life as a football manager. But then on the other hand, he's already been linked to that Leicester job, and there's talks that Leicester might try and get rid of Claude Puel and bring him in. And you would think naturally that's probably the right step for him. It's a club with a bigger budget, and it's a club where he could probably add his philosophy to a group of players who would be really good at pressing football. And that's where you just wonder, and that's where you maybe proved right. It may be a case of if he ends up going there, then we probably know that actually his heart wasn't in that Huddersfield job and he was just looking to progress his career.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I absolutely do think his heart was in the job, and I think, you know, he will have recognised that, unfortunately, and no disrespect to Huddersfield or himself, that ultimately they're not the biggest club. He's not the biggest manager, and I think even if you throw a lot of money at it, there's only so much money you can spend on certain players to bring in, and you know, again, no disrespect to Huddersfield, but they won't be bringing in the calibre of players that in the position they're in at the moment, they'll be able to progress. And I think, you know, unfortunately, he is left in an untenable position where he isn't going to be sacked, but from a reputation point of view, if he takes them down, you know, they finish mid-table in the Championship for another two seasons, then that's potentially his one opportunity gone. And, you know, and as we said, it will be a shame to see him take a Leicester job in a week's time, for instance. And if it was at the end of the season, then fair enough. But I think the biggest question mark for Huddersfield, and probably the main reason why they would hesitate on letting him go now, is who they're going to bring in next. Because, again, we go back to the fact that they don't have the biggest reputation, they don't have the biggest budget, and I think they have to look for someone progressive in the same way they did previously. Fortunately, it looks as though Sam Allardyce has been ruled out of the job.
Well, he's ruled himself out, hasn't he? He said not even I could keep Huddersfield up, which is relatively disrespectful from a man who's lost pretty much every job he's ever had.
And I think ultimately Huddersfield won't pay him what he would want as well. So that, you know, that's probably the bigger question there. But I'm intrigued to see what happens with them. You know, they, as we said, the story from last year was fantastic, and that's enough to kind of dine out on for the next 10 years for Huddersfield, for sure. And they will, if they are to be relegated, I suspect they'll be in a fantastic position to build something in the Championship. They will have, as I said last week, more money than they could ever dream of ever having as a football club. And the experience that the fans have had will be one that will stay with them forever. And David Wagner is at the heart of all of that.
Absolutely right. We need to move on.
Talking
of a club that spent a fair amount of time in the Championship in recent years, Newcastle United went to Stamford Bridge and, as everyone expected, came away with a 2-1 defeat. But it could have been quite different, couldn't it, this game? It wasn't as easy as it looked on paper.
No, I'll be honest, the game bored the hell out of me. I was at that beer festival watching it, and I was drinking to get away from it at that point. You know, it was another limping Chelsea performance, grinding out the win, and really, other than the moment of excitement when Newcastle equalised, you know, they played their part too in a fairly dour affair. And you look at Chelsea, they struggled with Hazard as the false nine. Giroud's on the bench, Morata left out altogether, and you know, even the fans are booing at half-time now, and you know, something has to give somewhere in that club. They've got a fantastic manager, a great squad, but they've just gone downhill in the last few weeks, despite the fact they are grinding out results.
That's it, they just need a little bit of a refreshment, don't they? January refreshment, bring a couple of new players in, get rid of a couple. If he doesn't like the way that Giroud and Morata play, then get rid of them. I'm not convinced that in Gonzalo Higuain that would bring a much of a different aspect. He doesn't really have much pace. He relies a lot on his positional play, and he's possibly more of a goal poacher than those two. And they obviously had a great time together at Napoli, him and Sarri, but I think the English league's so different. Defences in the English league don't tend to give you as much time or space, and I'm not convinced that that's what Chelsea need. I think they could do with a couple of better attacking footballers. I think that there's far too much put on Hazard's shoulders at the moment, and as soon as he has a bad game, people start to criticise the manager. And it was routine in terms of the end result, but not the way that Newcastle played that game. I think that it was more about the fact that Chelsea were able to kind of limp over the line, and on another day, a better team would have probably come away with something.
Newcastle won 1 in 10. Currently have their lowest points total at this stage of a season for 30 years. Benitez said before the game they can't even compete with Bournemouth in the transfer market, which, no disrespect to Bournemouth, is a shocker for a club the size of Newcastle. We saw Rio Ferdinand cause some controversy this weekend when he suggested fans should be thankful to Mike Ashley for spending his $50 million of his own money to get them promoted, despite generating $80 million in player sales. Rio then said the club aren't in debt, fans should be grateful. And then big old Alan Shearer, Newcastle hero, comes back to advise Rio that they're actually $140 million in debt.
Yeah, and fair play to Jake Humphrey on this one, because he actually called Rio Ferdinand out for the fact that his brand, I think it's number 5 or something like that, is his sports leisure wear is sold in Mike Ashley's shops. And you struggle to think why else he would be talking about this on national television, really. Why else would you back such a man as Mike Ashley? And then he had the audacity to put loads of fishing hooked emojis on Twitter, which, have a look at the comments on there, by all means. We can't really go into them in here because they're pretty poor. But I think you have to do your research, Rio. And I think that's the problem in this one. He hasn't done that. He's tried to maybe goad a few Newcastle fans into something. It's massively backfired.
I think what's arguably worse is that he did get some support
from a few people.
Yeah, he got some support from everyone's favourite hairy pundit, Richard Keys, who backed him, adding that Rafa Benitez should spend his own money if he wants to buy players. And the responses that he got were brilliant. Daniel Story, the journalist, asked him whether he pays the guests that come on his channel, whether he pays for new cameras if they need replacing. And one Twitter user asked Keys, if he was on glue, which delighted me, because the man is an idiot at the best of times. But tough times for Newcastle. A home game against Cardiff this weekend is absolutely massive before taking on Manchester City and Spurs. So huge game this weekend. Definitely an intriguing prospect. As is the Championship, which is where we're taking a trip to after this short break.
But I'll tell you can tell him now, if you're watching it, we're still fighting for this title, and he's got to go to Middlesbrough and get something. And I'll tell you, honestly, I will love it if we beat them. Love it.
Welcome back to part two of this week's Sweep Podcast, and we are taking a short trip to the Championship. And we'll start with the big game of the weekend, which had top billing on Friday. James Bond's Leeds United beat Frank Lampard's Derby County 2-0 to get back on track and keep hold of top spot in the league. And this came after Marcelo Bielsa admitted sending Spy to Derby's training ground to watch some training. Also admitted that he's been doing it for years, and quite frankly, he's not really that bothered, is he?
No, and not just any Spy, but I think it was his son-in-law. Like,
was it?
You're not going to say no to Marcelo Bielsa, are you? I'm really, yeah, Dad, that's fine. I'll just take my binoculars and
probably
go to
Derby. Even want to marry his daughter, to be honest. But behind Leeds are their Yorkshire rivals, Sheffield United, who beat QPR 1-0 to leapfrog Norwich on goal difference. And that was after the Canaries could only draw with West Brom 1-1. A good result in the grand scheme of things, especially when going behind early to a Dwight Gayle strike. And it taken until the last 10 minutes when Jordan Rhodes popped up with the equaliser. And Middlesbrough, the only other side we haven't mentioned in the top six, had an impressive away day at Birmingham, beating the Blues 2-1. And that leaves Borough just 4 points off the top two now. It's getting tighter up there each week.
It is indeed. And I think Tony Pulis does deserve a bit of credit. They went on an absolute stinker of a run a few weeks back, didn't they? And everyone kind of thought that would be it for their playoff hopes. But no, they've come back with a vengeance. And it's not an easy place to go, St Andrews.
No, it's not. And just outside those playoffs is the resurgent Bristol City, who, following a fantastic unbeaten streak and a home win against Bolton this weekend, have crept up the league. And they're just 2 points off Derby in sixth. And Hull as well, they continued their fine form too, winning their sixth game on the bounce, beating Sheffield Wednesday comfortably 3-0. And speaking of Sheffield Wednesday, the Owls, many will have seen they've appointed a new manager, Steve Bruce, who's just finishing his rest and his holiday before joining in February. And whilst we're on the managerial merry-go-round, Nottingham Forest have also parted company with their manager, Aitor Karanka, and swiftly replaced by Martin O'Neill, a hero in that part of the world, but a long time out of club management and not the greatest record when he was last there either. And it was a poor performance from Forest on Saturday as they lost 2-0 away at Reading, but just 4 points out of the playoffs, plenty to play for them, isn't there?
There are indeed. What about your boys, Aston Villa?
What about them?
Did they play?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, I thought they played at Wigan.
No, I was struggling to remember who we were playing last week, and I don't think that ever happened.
Okay, must have got it wrong, sorry.
Yeah, we definitely didn't lose 3-0. Dreadful performance. And you know, we're in a slump that we really do want to forget about. Wigan simply wanted it more, and we have to very much move on. Unfortunately, we move on to host Hull this weekend, which...
easy, you know, 3 points.
Yeah, given the most informed team in the league, it's probably not who we want to face at home, but two home games coming up, and yeah, it's crucial we get back on the horse. And I worry, because we haven't really done anything since we lost Jack Grealish to injury, and you don't ever want to be a one-player team like Southampton were in the 90s, but but that's what we seem to be at the moment. Well, I've got a dig at everything at the moment. So, but Ipswich at the foot of the table, where we'll be soon, got a rare win, just their third of the season, beating Rotherham at Portman Road, and still 7 points off getting out of the relegation zone, and they have to contend with others picking up results infrequently, but still more than them. So it's all going on. There's still about 4 points between pretty much sixth and bottom anyway, so anything can happen with two or three wins, and that's what I'm desperately hoping for Villa.
I'm missing the midweek fixtures in the Championship.
There
haven't been very many since Christmas.
The more breaks, the better. we just delay the inevitable then.
Talking of delaying the inevitable, we've talked so much about everything else, but now we have to make that trip over to Portugal, and it was a massive game in the Portuguese Primeira Liga, with Sporting Lisbon hosting league leaders Porto, and it was dreadful. It was a big old 0-0, which leaves Sporting in fourth and Porto top. However, their lead was cut to 5 points due to Benfica winning 2-0 away at Santa Clara. Sporting did give it their all, and I think they were pretty much the better side in this one. They definitely had the better chances, but even with big, bad Baz Dost, they couldn't break the deadlock. They won't be too downhearted. They still have a seven-point cushion between them and Vitória in fifth, so European qualification is very much on the cards. They're only 3 points behind second for Champions League qualification, however, and it should be a great second half of the season with the biggest game coming in just a few weeks' time in the big derby de Lisboa with Benfica for our Lisbon Lions. I've got a fact for you, Mitch.
Hit me.
Are you ready
with it.
For this one?
Yep.
I asked you this, didn't I, before we started recording, and you absolutely nailed it. Second top appearance holder for Sporting Lisbon, currently plays in the Premier League and goes by the name of Rui Patricio with 464 games. If he'd have held on for another 31, he would have been their all-time leading appearance holder.
It's a decent record by all means.
You're blown away by that, aren't you? And that's it for the Portuguese roundup. Join us after this break when we get back to Premier League action.
It promises to be another special Champions League evening, and here to enjoy it all with us are Rio Ferdinand, Steven Gerrard and Ian Wright. All three have had their hands on this trophy, Rio and Steven in Moscow and Istanbul respectively, and Ian when he walked into the studio this evening. I've been looking forward to that all day.
I just should have said when I walked into the studio and grabbed the back of your head.
great.
Welcome back to the third part of this week's Sweeper Podcast, and it's time to go down to sunny Brighton, where the Seagulls succumbed to a 1-0 defeat by league leaders Liverpool.
So it wasn't a vintage Liverpool performance. However, whilst we may have criticised them slightly at the beginning of the season for not playing the attacking, swashbuckling football we've become accustomed to, I'd say actually they're comfortably seeing games out and learning how to win dirty and have a bit more patience and being a bit more mature, and I think they just keep making sure the points roll in, because Brighton's not an easy place to go, and I think, you know, a couple of tough weeks for Liverpool as well. This was always going to be a tough game, and it, as I say, it was a very mature performance. I think we have to give them a huge amount of credit.
Workmanlike, yes. I think, is the word. They had just over 70% possession away from home, and they were in full control. It was 0-0 at half-time, and I think Manchester City fans everywhere were getting very, very excited about the possibility of Liverpool dropping points, but it didn't happen, and we'll get onto the penalty in a second, but I think that Liverpool have drawn on the experience that they've probably gained earlier on in the season, where they've won games at a canter and then probably gone into games thinking that they were going to steamroller teams. Like you say, they've learned how to win differently now, and I thought that Brighton might be a potential banana skin for them.
Me too, yeah.
And to come away from there not only with the win but with another clean sheet is massive. And the great thing about the Premier League going forward, although that Liverpool and Manchester City have played each other twice now, so we're not going to get to see that massive head-to-head towards the end of the season, what it will mean is that whoever plays first out of those two teams is able to put immense pressure on the other side.
Yep.
And actually, if you don't win your game going first, it's not the end of the world, because there's a possibility that the other team might drop points. But by winning this game, Liverpool extended the lead to 10 points again. And although the game could have been much different between Manchester City and Wolves on Monday night, it put an added pressure to that City side. And they haven't really experienced that for a little while, have they?
If you've got the cushion, does it make you relax a bit more and become more comfortable, or does it actually put the pressure on you? Does it creep in on you knowing that, yes, you have got the cushion, but you've also got something to defend? Whereas Manchester City have kind of, you know, they're free for all now, aren't they? They just have to win every single game.
I think that the fact that Liverpool have got a 4-point lead, it wouldn't really have worried them too much. I think had they dropped points at Brighton, the best that City could have done would have been to get within 1 point of them, and ultimately it's still in Liverpool's hands at that point. I think that it's just going to create so much narrative between now and the end of the season, and it means that going into every single week, whoever plays first has the advantage. If City win, they put pressure on Liverpool. If Liverpool win, then the gap's going to widen. And I just think that Liverpool are going to have to learn how to handle this, and they're probably having to do quite a lot of training off the pitch. And when I say off the pitch, I mean, there's a lot mentally to go into to holding on to titles, and Klopp will be able to draw on the experience that he had over in Dortmund, because when Dortmund won league titles, Bayern were always snapping at their heels, and it's something that he will be used to, but a lot of the players will never have been in this position before, and Liverpool fans will know better than many that they will get anxious towards the end of the season, and they need to ensure that the players have a different mindset. So when it comes to the crucial last few games, they go into them knowing that they can win.
As you said, the goal came from the penalty spot with Mo Salah firing home. And penalty for you? You happy with that?
It looks like a penalty from one angle, and then from the other angle it doesn't. I think that there is contact there, and I think that you know how quickly Mo Salah moves. It's likely that he's going to go down in that scenario, and I don't think that you can blame him. I think if you were a Brighton fan, you would probably feel a little bit hard done by, but if you're a Liverpool fan, then you would expect that to be given. And I think it's one of those that I think by the law, it probably is the right decision. What about you?
Yeah, it was a penalty for me, and you know, I think you look at Brighton, you know what you're going to get from them in these games at the Amex, and in this one, they were just beaten by the better side. It'll be frustrating, but very much on to the next one, and it doesn't get any easier with a trip to Old Trafford against probably the most informed team in the league at the moment. But we talk about inform, and Manchester City in the last three games have scored nearly 20 goals. You could argue the opposition until last night have been miles and miles away from them, but you still have to win those games, and they're putting teams to bed with relative ease at the moment. And you know, they closed that gap last night with that win over Wolves 3-0, and the early lead following Jesus scoring probably the most typical goal from Manchester City that you'll see, tapping inside the 6-yard box from a drilled in cross. And I think from there, the night didn't get any easier for Wolves, did it?
It didn't, and Willy Bolly's tackle was very reminiscent of a certain Vincent Kompany's a week or so ago, and that's where this consistency piece that we often talk about in the Premier League has to come into question, because he took the ball first, yep, and then he took the man, and I think he was very noble in the way that he took the decision. He understood, the referee explained to him why he'd been sent off, and even after the game he came out and he apologised to Bernardo Silva. And I don't know whether that's just the fact that they've both played for clubs in Portugal and maybe they know each other from that side of things, but you look at that tackle and I struggle to see many differences between that and Kompany's. In fact, I think that the distance off the ground that Kompany was when he was just given a yellow card, it leaves me scratching my head a little bit.
I think it's the actual contact, isn't it? Because I think Salah moved to kind of get out of the way a little bit more than Silva, but you're right, you know, there does have to be a level of consistency, and you know, unfortunately that's probably not going to come in. Even if VAR's there, I'm not even sure whether that would be something that could be looked at. But I think, you know, there is naturally always human error when there's referees involved, and I think equally, certainly in the middle of the pitch as well, I think you kind of miss it sometimes as much as you see it as well. So potentially that was the case. But I think going back to the game, their credit, I thought Wolves kept themselves in the game well, and despite conceding the penalty and ultimately the second goal for Jesus, they didn't necessarily threaten much, but I thought they contained Manchester City very well, and I think with 11 players on the pitch, they would have made it even harder for them.
I think you look at the fact that they've scored 16 goals in the last two home games, regardless of the opposition. If I was a Wolves fan last night, I would have been terrified, yeah, when Bolly got sent off, because you can see what Manchester City are able to do to sides when you give them that space. But they didn't do that. They got into two banks of five, basically, and I include the goalkeeper in that, because the back four basically dropped back so far that at times they were defending their own 18-yard box, yep, with all 10 players behind the ball. And I think that Nuno Espirito Santo deserves credit for that. I think that we often will look at games like this and think, well, it was a routine win for Manchester City, and you can't really argue with that, but it could have been a lot different. And I think that there will be elements of the game that Wolves will come away from and actually think, do you know what, we can take that into the next one, whereas another team could quite easily have capitulated and let in six or seven in that position.
And on to the next one. It's a big game for Wolves this weekend. They take on Leicester at home, and you know, that's the game they want to win, isn't it? That's where they want to get their points. And last point on Manchester City, good to see De Bruyne coming into the action off the bench, and you know, he was all over the place for the last 25 minutes or so. He was on the ball a lot, showed glimpses of quality as we know he's got, with balls into the box, including the one that flicked off Connor Cody for the third. And I thought he looked like he'd slimmed down a little too. You know, he's hardly a big lad, but he looked slim. And I wonder, what impact will he have in the second half of the season?
I don't think that you can underestimate that he will have an impact. He's one of the best players in European football. And the difference between not having him in prior to Christmas and potentially having him in after Christmas, week in, week out, could be the gap that they need to bridge between them and Liverpool. He'll be like a new signing, and everybody knows what he was able to do last season, and I don't think that anyone will look forward to facing that Manchester City side with him in there.
Let's move down to South London, where there's a lively encounter between Crystal Palace and Watford, and Watford won the game 2-1, but how is your look when you hit the post twice in the first 3 minutes in the same move?
And it was a sign of things to come, really, wasn't it? Watford were... They attacked, they had vigour, they had a lot of pace going forward, and Palace actually decided to just go head-to-head with them, really, and throw players forward. And it's great to see, because Crystal Palace have played within themselves quite a lot this season, but I think they've got confidence from their recent wins, and it showed. They took the lead, and it was scrappy. It wasn't the best goal in the world, and it happens so often, doesn't it? Craig Cathcart scored the own goal, and then... Funnily enough, it was him who got the equaliser in the second half.
It is a lovely quirk to the game, isn't it? It's one that we've seen 47 times now in the Premier League. And two clubs, little question for you, two clubs have had four players apiece completing this impressive feat. Who are they?
I'm guessing that I don't get any points if I get this one right.
No.
So there's two clubs in Premier League history who have had four players apiece completing this impressive feat. I'm going to go for Liverpool.
Nope.
And Everton.
No. Arsenal.
Wow.
And Southampton.
Really?
Yeah.
That doesn't surprise me that we've scored a fair whack of own goals in our time.
I know, right. But no, it is exciting when it happens. And, you know, the one that springs to mind is one, it was a nearly and a maybe, actually. Do you remember John Walters when he scored two own goals and missed a penalty?
Yeah. And didn't one of the own goals, didn't he, like, kick it in off his face or something like
that? Yeah, probably. Something ridiculous. But, yeah, it was, you know, I think in this one, obviously, Cathcart's gone and grabbed the goal. And from there, it's end-to-end stuff. Obviously, Palace needed the win. Watford, you suspect, with a little less to lose. I just thought, why not? But equally, I don't think they know any other way, do they, Watford? They just kind of go for it every week anyway.
And that's what must be great as a Watford fan. You go into games knowing that you're going to try and win them, whereas in previous seasons, especially under Sanchez Flores, there was almost this option when you go ahead in games that you do just try and close out, whereas in games nowadays, they don't tend to do that. They do try and go for the throat, and I think that they probably deserve the victory when you look back at it, and they're probably the informed team outside the top six in the top half of the table. They've gone to places like Crystal Palace and West Ham in the last few weeks, and they've won games. And I think if you're able to do that against the sides that are around you, then you will begin to build a cushion and be able to look forward rather than over your shoulder.
And the winner was in the top corner, straight out of the top drawer. And I want to get your thoughts on Tom Cleverley. He's been out injured quite a lot, and you know, we've spoken about a number of individuals for Watford, and I think he slots in that squad quite well, and I think the football they play probably suits him. But, you know, it was only probably 3 or 4 years ago that he was a regular in England squads. He was regularly playing for Manchester United. He's had a couple of loans elsewhere, and is he the sort of player that builds on this and continues to improve, or is he just someone now who very much is a fringe player in the Premier League?
I think that the competition for places at Watford is very high, especially in his position. A lot will depend on whether the move for Decore goes through with PSG. I'm not sure whether that's going to happen or not, but you would imagine that if he was to leave, then there's a spot in there if Cleverley wants it. The issue that he's always had is injuries, and that level of consistency since leaving Manchester United. A lot of people, thought that he would be a player who would probably go to a club just outside the top four or even the top six and perform very well in there, and it's just not happened for him. And it was a really nice goal. It was very well taken, and it was reminiscent of a Tom Cleverley of those early Manchester United days, who used to make runs into the box of late. And it's frustrating from his point of view that his career's gone off the rails a little bit, but under Javi Grazia he's got a really good opportunity of getting back to where he needs to be.
Excitingly, we've also got the Benteke ticker back up and running, who It's been a long time coming for us, really, to have this feature back up and running. It probably holds our show together once it's going as well. So we're very excited about Christian Benteke coming back, and hopefully, bless the man, he scores a few goals because he deserves it. He's worked hard, and fingers crossed he gets a little bit of luck, which is what Everton got this weekend, beating Bournemouth 2-0. And as I say, Bournemouth were unlucky, certainly early on in the game anyway. They were the brighter team, took the game to Everton, and unfortunately they couldn't make it count, and they do really miss Callum Wilson when he's not there. And does that spell trouble were he to leave the club? I mean, guessing that's why they want so much money, so he could be replaced.
Yeah, I mean, the talks of 75 million
are,
I mean, I don't know whether they're wide of the mark or whether what's being reported is true, but I mean, fair play to Bournemouth. You've got a prize asset and you want to try and hold on to them. And I think that if he was to leave, then Dominic Solanke's not going to be able to step into those shoes straight away. They're completely different players, and you would expect Bournemouth probably to dip into the market again, especially if they are given a fair whack of money. If somebody like Chelsea want him, then you couldn't blame Wilson for wanting to go there. He's not particularly young in terms of a Premier League career. I think he's 26, and he's been through a couple of really bad injuries, so you'd expect he would want to take the opportunity to go to a top four side.
Given Everton haven't won at home in the previous four games, it was crucial that they got the 3 points, and especially against a mid-table rival, one that spent a fraction of money that they have over the last few years as well. And you know, they improved a lot in the second half. Richarlison looked brighter, but still no goal, which we'll get onto later in the show. And then Kurt Zouma grabs the opener, and there's a real sense of relief around Goodison Park. And I'd say it still wasn't plain sailing. They still couldn't really push for the second until the last second of the game, when Calvert-Lewin slotted in. And you know, we spoke last week about whether Everton have got issues. You know, the fans are starting to murmur a little bit in the stands. They've put everything on Marco Silva, even after Koeman went last season. You know, they've spent a lot of money, 3 points better off than last season, but they're in 10th. And I'd say, you know, in a season where they, you know, one of the top six until recently, Manchester United, have had as bad a season as you could have, and surely that's Everton's chance to just pile on the pressure. That's their chance to get in there.
And you wonder how long this pressure will continue to build on him. What's the target now for Everton this season? What's realistic? I think that they're going to have to go for that seventh place, and you would argue that anything that's below that will probably be seen as a failure, given the amount, like you say, that they spent in the summer. You would probably imagine that they'll be pleased as a set of fans with the majority of the signings. I think that in Luca Dean, they've got a great defender, somebody that continues to provide assists and
yep.
plays a large part in the attacking football that Silva likes to play. But then you wonder what they're going to do in this transfer window. I think Silva's been quoted as saying that if they're going to bring anyone in, then they have to sell people first. They've been linked with Cedric Suarez from Southampton, and I think he's in a difficult position, Marco Silva. He did so well early in the season, and you wonder if that's actually been detrimental in the long term, because the expectations were raised by Everton fans at that point.
Potentially. And speaking of expectations, the final game of the weekend, we saw West Ham United beat Arsenal, and I would say the first half of this game really looked like two teams that just didn't want to win. Particularly Arsenal. You know, we've become accustomed to their lacklustre first half performances, but this was probably about as bad as it got, to be honest. And you know, to their credit, they still managed to get in at 0-0. But West Ham did spring into life towards the end of that first half, and then the second half they were all over it. Later on in the game, they had Andy Carroll, who came on to batter everyone. Sami Nasri looked lively as well in patch. I was surprised that he's getting a start so quick. And
he should look lively. He's had about 18 months out of football.
And a lot of oxygen in his blood as well. And, you know, Arnautovic was the one. He was just strolling around. He looked like he wanted to go to China, to be honest.
He did, didn't he? And I think that he probably will end up there. There's no point in keeping a player against their will at the club. He is a mercenary. We all know that. We know that when he went from Stoke to West Ham, he went for the wages. He didn't necessarily think that he was going to further his footballing career. But look how that turned out. Stoke are now in the Championship and struggling, and West Ham are doing really well in the Premier League. But
and
I want to get your
opinion
on
that. The club that he goes to in China could win the Chinese Super League.
And that's not really something that you want on your CV, is it? I think it's more to do with the reported £200,000 a week.
And why wouldn't you, though? You know, where's he going to go? Realistically, where is he going to go that he will win trophies on
a
regular basis?
I think that's the danger of it all, isn't it? There's not a top four side or a top six side that will come in, because consistently he's not done enough over his career to merit a move to a club of that size. West Ham's probably the perfect club for him. I think that they try to punch above their weight. They have fans with high expectations, and you would think that the money that he's on at the moment, which is a reported £120,000 a week, would be more than enough for somebody. But like you said to me the other day, if a bin man gets offered triple his wages, then he'll go to do a different job. And that's the way that Arnautovic will look at it. He's probably getting bad advice from those around him. I don't think that his brother has come out of this with any real credit. But
he's come out of it with a lot of money, though.
Well, exactly. And that's it. If you're getting your client an extra couple of £100,000 a week, then you can't really argue with that. And it's such a difficult one. And you thought this whole Chinese market had slowed down a little bit when they brought in the rules around salary caps and how many players they could have from foreign teams, but it looks like it's just going to start up again. And looks like Arnautovic could be another one to go over and play in the Super League that is Chinese football.
Absolutely. And you know, we go back to the game. The goal came early in the second half, as I said, and first Premier League strike for the Basmati Busquets, Declan Rice.
What a nickname that is.
It's fantastic. It made my day when I saw that, I'll be honest.
Do you think
it's a highlight to my week so far?
Do you think he's got an Uncle Ben?
Yeah, very good. Very, very good. Any more?
No, that's it. No.
It's another impressive performance from Noah. And, you know, given the amount of praise he's receiving, the question of him playing for England will no doubt crop up again. And what do you do? What do you do as Declan Rice? You've had three appearances for Ireland in a three friendlies, and you potentially got the opportunity to go and play for England. Do you, let's say hypothetically, do you risk getting a handful of caps for England? You could go on and be the best player we've ever had. Or do you, again, no disrespect to Ireland, but do you almost kind of cement yourself in an international side for years to come?
I, as an Englishman, would definitely choose to play for England, regardless of whether I had caps for the Republic of Ireland or not. I think the decision will be made at some point, and I think he probably will decide to go for England because it's the country of his birth. It's the country that he's played football in all of his life, and I think he'll probably look at somebody like Mark Noble, who's done consistently well for West Ham but has never had that chance for England, and he'll probably see that...
And laugh in his face.
Yeah, and that's it, because Southgate wants him, and that's the difference. I think that they'll probably wait to get the Nations League tournament finals out of the way in the summer, and then it wouldn't surprise me to see him in friendly squads going forward.
I'll predict that if Southgate wants him, he'll put him in for one game, and that's when Southgate will get done like Allardyce did with a towel over his head.
End up at Manchester United.
Yeah, exactly, and then Rice has lost every chance to ever play for England ever again. But huge win for West Ham. They were good value. Arsenal, on the other hand, were poor. You know, no wins in five away from home, not kept a clean sheet in over a month, and a busy month as well. You know, they welcome Chelsea to the Emirates next, and with Manchester United now level on points, they need to get back up and run again.
They do indeed, yeah. Emery's going to come under a little bit of pressure because obviously they went on that fantastic run. They need the Europa League back. That was the springboard for their decent league form earlier in the season, so he'll be praying for that Thursday night football.
Join us after this break for some quiz loving.
Hey, I want to hear about what Danny did.
Where's
Danny? That was nothing.
Oh, sure, nothing so good,
come
right?
Come on, Danny. You got her drawers, right?
Yeah. Come on. Tell us about that girl.
What'd you do this summer, Sandy?
Oh, I spent most of the...
Where's...
I met a boy there.
All your cookies all the way...
Where's...
Some guy?
He was sort of special.
There ain't no such thing.
He was really romantic.
Come on, you don't want to hear all the horny details.
Are you kidding me?
Had me a blast.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's Sweeper Podcast, and it's almost time for Mitch to get his bot hot in
Yay.
The hottest of seats.
Can't wait
for the quiz. But before we get to that, he's going to let you know how you can get in contact with us.
You can get us on Twitter at The Sweep Pod, search us on Instagram and Facebook, The Sweep Podcast, and get us on email at thesweeperpodcast@gmail.com. And while we're on it, get us all over the show to listen to us as well. You can get us on iTunes, subscribe, rate and review, pass it on, share it, tell all your friends, tell your family, tell your dog. Spotify, Audio Boom, Anchor, Deezer, YouTube, Google, you name it, we're on there.
We are indeed. And before we get to the quiz, we're going to give you a little update on how we're getting on with our Brazilian chap, Richarlison, on Merseyside, and that bet with listener Eddie Lee. Now, for those of you who aren't aware of this, we had a little wager early doors, about how many goals Richarlison would score, because he went off the board a little bit last season when it was cold, and we thought that he wouldn't do that well. Now, since then, we have to caveat that Everton have moved him into a central position, so the whole thing is essentially null and void. But being the great guys we are, we've decided to keep the bet going. So, at this stage of the... I think there's about 20 games, aren't there, between the start and the finish of the cold snap in Britain.
It's probably about 30.
Well, yeah, but the ones that we're counting, I think we're about halfway into them. I think he scored five goals.
In 12 games. Eddie did get in touch with us, though, at the 9 mark, and was quite happy that he'd scored 5 in 9. And he's been quite quiet the last 3 games.
Yeah, they're playing Southampton on Saturday, so it's going to be double jeopardy for me, I think. Richarlison goals and a Southampton loss. But keep up with that one, because if we are able to keep it under 9 goals, then we'll have some money going to charity, won't we?
Absolutely. Should we do it?
Let's get into it. The quiz. Mitch is in the hot seat, like I just said. And before we go there, he's going to let you know what the scores are.
Do I have to?
You do. You do.
Scores are 21-11, I believe. And let's leave it at that.
Okay, then. So your first question is R, and it's for relegation and record breakers. Who, in 2004-2005, broke the curse of the team lying bottom of the Premier League at Christmas, having always been relegated?
West Bromwich Albion.
West Bromwich Albion, he's off the mark.
I was going to ask you this last week.
Really?
Yeah.
He's 1-1. It's a good start. Your next question is T. Now, T is for third highest.
God.
And we're talking transfers here. Neymar cost $198 million when he moved from Barcelona to PSG in 2017. Kylian Mbappe cost the same club £158 million the year after, putting him second on the all-time list. What I want you to tell me is simple enough. Which player who cost £106 million is third on the all-time transfer list?
Really, really, really hoping that Mbappe was third then.
No. 106 million.
Yeah, 106
million. £106 million.
I will go with Gareth Bale.
It's not Gareth Bale. Gareth Bale was around the 90 mark. Right. It was a transfer involving an English and a Spanish club. But the other one, not Real Madrid.
Ronaldo?
No, it was Philippe Coutinho leaving Liverpool for Barcelona. Your third question...
What an absolute shit show that is, by the way.
Your third question is all about Nicholas Anelka, and it's your 50-50, so N is for Nicholas. Who did the moody Frenchman play more games for, Manchester City or Arsenal?
I will go with... Did we decide I've got to go in my gut or go with the opposite?
We decided you didn't need to think too much about it.
Right, so I've already thought too much about it, haven't I? I'll go with Manchester City.
Is correct. He's got one of the 50-50s right. Oh. 89 appearances for Manchester City and only 65 for Arsenal.
It'd have been a guaranteed starter, wouldn't it? Assuming he was fit, he'd have always started for them.
That's right. And that's 2 out of 3, Mitch.
Wow.
66.6% so far. Christ. Now, S is for Southampton. My beloved Southampton. Two Saints players were named in the 2013-2014 PFA Team of the Season.
Had your book out again, have you?
One. No. This one's off the top of my head. One was Adam Lallana. But which defender was in there? So, I'll recap for you. S is for Southampton. Two Saints players were named in the 2013-2014 PFA Team of the Season. One was Adam Lallana. But which defender was in there?
It surely can't be Fonte, so I'm not going to say that. I will say it's between two.
Right, which two is it between? Come on, Mitch. Let's see if either of them are right.
It's between Toby Alderweireld.
Right.
And Nathaniel Clyne.
Okay.
Is it either of those two?
No.
Right, okay.
I think you've had enough clues, given that it's your 50-50. You're just going to have to go for it.
I'll not take the point. It's not Luke Shaw, is it?
It is Luke Shaw.
Is it?
And I'll give you the point because you got the answer right. I don't think that I can take that away from you. That's 3 out of 4,
Mitch.
That would
be ridiculous.
And do you know what? The last question's very, very gettable.
Right,
as an Aston Villa fan.
Oh.
So P...
We always agree we'd never ask each other.
It's not an Aston Villa-based question.
All right, okay.
But P is for Peter Schmeichel.
Right.
Can you tell me which European side he joined upon leaving Manchester United in 1999?
Sporting Lisbon.
Is correct. He's 4 from 5. He's 80%. He's over the moon. And
you should have realised when we were doing our just set the scene before the podcast. We were talking about Rui Patricio because he was the fact in the Sporting Lisbon fact of the day. Now, oddly, I've got almost a Rain Man technique with Sporting Lisbon goalkeepers. So you shot yourself in the foot there. So never ask me about.
I'll make sure that I don't ask you any more questions about Sporting keepers. I'm delighted for you because we had a pretty shocking review, didn't we, on iTunes recently? And that review was based purely on your performance in the quiz.
I want to invite him on.
Let's get
him to the quiz.
Not that he'll still be listening, because I think his comments on there were relatively poor. But
I'll find him.
He said that he thought the podcast was great until it got to the quiz, and then it all went to pieces.
And it was my week, and I was
clearly
terrible.
And clearly, we know nothing about football, because I think you got none out of five. But you've redeemed yourself, Mitch. You're back on the quiz horse, and I'm looking forward to what should be a really good battle between now and the end of the season.
Indeed. I'm looking forward to this weekend. Some great games coming up, and no doubt a lot of talking points ready for next week.
Absolutely. Southampton are at home to Everton. I'm expecting a very, very stern test. Villa?
Not playing
this week. No,
we dropped out.
Okay. I thought that might be the case.
No, we're going to lose to Hull.
We've got a ban on Villa. So hopefully that ban will be lifted and Mitch will be happy to talk about a home victory for the Villains this time next week.
Indeed. Sayonara.
Au revoir.